Hello and welcome to another edition of Jaw Law, where we talk about the intersection between law and dentistry. I'm your host, Joe McGregor, and today we're going to talk about the concept of non-compete. We're going to talk about it in the broader context of restraints of trade. Now, where most people understand this is when they sign a dental employment contract. And part of that contract is going to have a non-compete that's going to say that after they get fired or they quit or whatever the case may be, once they stop working for that office, they're not going to practice dentistry within the next 5 miles for the next 2 years or something like that. And so the question that usually gets asked to us is after someone has left the employ of a practice and they found a nice job or they want to buy a practice that appears to violate the restrictive covenant, at that point, that's where most people ask us, hey, is this enforceable? And so I basically want to have that conversation with everyone. But in order to have that, we're going to have to kind of lay out a little bit of context. And as we're laying out this context, we have to throw out a couple of caveats. The biggest caveat that exists in restrictive covenants is that this is a very, very state-specific topic. We're located in Dallas, Texas, so obviously we're going to approach restrictive covenants with a very heavy Texas bent, but we do engage restrictive covenants in various states. And so we have enough familiarity to know that how each state addresses restrictive covenants is very varied. The other thing to know about restrictive covenants is that it is a very local issue, and so local that I would argue that it is a courtroom issue. You can have a restrictive covenant here in Dallas, Texas, and you can go into one courtroom and get it enforced and go to the next courtroom and not get it enforced. It is a very, very case-by-case body of law, and courts in most states go to great lengths to ensure that it stays case-by-case. And I say that because we have a lot of people who come in and they're so sure of themselves. They're like, yeah, I signed this, but these aren't enforceable. Or I signed it, but it said 7 miles, and 7 miles is not enforceable. Nobody can know that right off the bat. There has to be some kind of analysis. And that doesn't mean they're wrong. It just means that if they haven't thought through it, they may be wrong and just not know it. But if there's one piece of advice I could throw out before we get started, is that never sign a restrictive covenant thinking that it's not going to be enforceable. The reality is if it is on your piece of paper and you live in a state where there is a possibility that a restrictive covenant could be enforceable, then it's there until a court says it's not. And so it might be obviously unenforceable, but if it's still on that piece of paper, then you might run into problems. Future employers might not want to touch it. Some banks may not want to touch it. If you find the perfect practice and you have a 10-mile restrictive covenant, and you're 9 miles in, you're pretty sure that it's not enforceable. Well, a bank doesn't know that until they know it. And that's not something you want to deal with in the future. You want to deal with it now. So now that we got that out of the way, let's talk, what is a restrictive covenant? A restrictive covenant is what we call a restraint of trade. And this is a body of law that's pretty consistent throughout all the states and in the country. And a restraint of trade, if you think about it, it's just any kind of law that's trying to limit the competition in the marketplace. In general, this country as a whole does not like to limit competition. We believe in our capitalist minds that competition is good. That being said, it sometimes is hard to get people to invest in technology, in developing goodwill, things like that, unless they can reasonably expect that their investment's going to be protected. So the courts and most states have tried to balance this concept out between allowing competition in the marketplace and facilitating and promoting economic growth and investment in business. The three types of restraints of trade that we see most often in dentistry are the concept of confidentiality, and this isn't HIPAA confidentiality or anything. It's the concept of trade secrets. Do you have certain ways of doing things, manuals, forms, financial information about the practice, patient lists, you know, just whatever you would not like other people to know. That's a trade secret, and you want to keep those things confidential. The second one that probably most people know, it's the non-compete, and this is the geographic and time restriction on being able to practice your trade near your place of employment. And then finally, there's the non-solicitation. And non-solicitation just means, can you recruit the patients that you developed a relationship with, and can you recruit your coworkers that you used to work with? And just all three of the non-competes, non-solicitations, and restrictions on confidentiality, non-disclosure, things like that, we just kind of generically refer to them as restrictive covenants. And a covenant just means a promise. So you're promising to limit your ability to use this information or relationships. Now, like I said, the place where we see these the most is in an employment agreement. And that's how we're going to talk about them today. It also is a critical part of selling the dental practice, but most of what we're going to talk about applies the same. So it's probably just easier to talk about it in terms of a dental employment rather than dental practice acquisition. So in the context of dental employment, the concept of goodwill is really what provides ammunition for protecting a dental practice. As an example to what I was speaking about earlier, Texas has a prohibition against restraints of trade, but also has this Covenants Not to Compete Act that does allow it. And I think Texas's law is a pretty good illustration of what's going on out there and the various other rules. But in Texas, you have to have a couple of ingredients in order to make a non-compete enforceable. And the first thing you have to have is this concept that it is ancillary to or part of an otherwise enforceable agreement at the time the agreement is made. What does that mean? It basically just means, you know, number one, is there an enforceable agreement? And this goes to kind of contracts 101, law school stuff, where if you don't have a viable contract, then it doesn't exist. And that means, importantly, that there has to be what we call in law consideration paid. So you can't just enforce something because somebody said, hey, I promise I'm not going to work here. You have to essentially buy your way into that restrictive covenant. And the second is that, and this is kind of a technical phrase that Texas uses, it has to be ancillary to or part of that agreement. And without getting too legalese about it, basically the concept is that it has to relate to what you're trying to protect. So in other words, you can't restrict somebody from doing something that they didn't do for you. For instance, you'd have to be careful, because I'm familiar with at least one case where there was a restrictive covenant that said you couldn't work in a practice in any capacity, and the judge threw that out saying, well, if they were working as a front desk receptionist, for instance, then that's overbroad. You could do that, and that's not reasonably restricting the nature of that restrictive covenant. And that's actually debatable, I would argue. But that's what happened in that case. In summary, it has to protect what it is the business is trying to protect. And if it's not protecting what it is you're trying to protect, then you run afoul of the law. Now, that's just the first part. The second part is it has to be reasonable. And this is where I think everyone gets into trouble. Because what is reasonable? Well, I don't know. If you know, let me know. And this is where people really get tripped up, because no one really knows what reasonable means. And this is what I meant earlier when courts like to keep this case by case, because it's going to take an individual court case, whether it be a judge or a jury, to define what reasonable means in that context. And the reasonableness has to relate to the time, so you can't do 100 years. It has to relate to the geographical area. You can't do 100 miles if all you've worked is in one office and you draw your patients from the proximate 5 miles. And the scope of activity, that has to be reasonable as well. So you have to restrict the dentist based on what they're doing. And what's important to remember is that there are no standards. So what might be reasonable in one case won't be reasonable in another, or necessarily reasonable. So 2 years may make sense for one transaction. 5 years may make sense for another. 2 miles may make sense. In fact, 2 miles may be unreasonably long in one scenario and unreasonably short in another. What we like to tell people is there's this range of reasonability where employers, they always want the most protection possible, but there's a point at which they're asking for something that's unreasonable. Similarly, employees are always interested in making the scope as little as possible, but there's a point where it's just unreasonable. It's not, you're not going to protect the business. And in between those two points of reasonability, well, that's all just negotiation. But a word about geographic scope. Most courts define geographic scope, reasonable geographic scope, to be where you worked. Well, in dentistry, that's a little tough because most of the times we're talking about one office. So how do you define where you work if you only work in one office? What we've seen is that it's more about where you draw your patients from. And so, for instance, if you're in a rural area and you're drawing your patients from a very wide radius, then you're going to get away with a wider restrictive covenant than if you're in the middle of the city. It also has to do, at least in some courts, with patient choice. And those probably go hand in hand, but if the patient has a ton of choices between you and your old employer, well, it's going to be harder for that to be enforced. So for instance, if you've got a 6-mile restrictive covenant and you only pass one dental, or a patient pass one dental office between here and there, well, that's probably going to be enforceable. Whereas if they're going to pass 32 dental offices in those 6 miles, then that's going to be harder to enforce. The patient has that much more patient choice. Now, one of the overlooked aspects of non-competes is the non-solicitation. If you are a practice owner, you probably should care more about the solicitation. If one of your former employees goes across the street and doesn't take a single patient away from you, you might not be that thrilled that you have competition so close, but at least you have your patients. Whereas if they go, you've got a 10-mile restrictive covenant and they go 11 miles away, but they take half your patients because they were such a winning person, then they followed the letter of the law that you spelled out and it still hurt you. So we think that non-solicitation is probably even more important than the geographic restriction. And most people get hung up on the geographic restriction. No, I need 2 miles. No, I need 5. But in reality, what they're going to care the most about is, or at least business owners, what they're going to care the most about is, how am I going to keep my patients here? Because if you think about it, you want your associates to be winners and you want them to have positive interactions, good chairside manners, basically the very attributes that your patients are going to want to stick with. And if that dentist leaves, they should want to go with them, except for that restrictive covenant. The other place a non-solicitation is incredibly meaningful is the solicitation of staff. If you are a young associate and you are about to go practice at another practice, or especially if you're about to go open your own practice, one of the dangers that we see is that this young associate gets a prime window into great staff. If you're working with 4 staffers and you're like, man, this one over here is fantastic, I'm going to go offer that person a little bit more money and take her with me. Now, I'm going to leave the other ones and I'll go recruit other people. Solicitation of staff is one of the most damaging solicitations that occurs in a practice. And if you're the practice owner, you run the danger of losing. No, nobody wants to take your worst staffer. If they did, this would be a great thing. But they don't. They take your best. And so you need to protect your best employees and prevent them from working. And a lot of times people will raise the question and say, well, wait a minute. I live in a right-to-work state. I can't do that. Well, actually, we're not abrogating that patient's right to work. What we're saying is we're entering into a contractual agreement where that associate is promising not to solicit or not to hire even. And so we're not actually doing anything with the employee. We're doing it with the associate. Now we're going to step into a little bit of law technicality. There's this concept in restrictive covenants called reformation. And this exists in contract law in general, but it's the question that gets asked, well, I want to violate my restrictive covenant. What's going to happen to me? Well, that's a tough question to answer because most of the time it is answered by, well, how hungry is your former employer for a legal battle? We have seen people be very forgiving of people who violate their restrictive covenants, probably grossly, I would say, just flagrantly violating restrictive covenants. At the same time, we've seen people just blow tens of thousands of dollars fighting restrictive covenant battles where the associate's not even doing damage to the practice. They're just trying to prove a point. And those become really tough to predict. But as far as the law is concerned, every state will have a different approach to how they're going to define their position on restrictive covenants. That's why we say this is such a state-specific conversation. In general, there's this concept called blue penciling a covenant. And that just means that a court is either permitted or sometimes obligated to strike language from the contract. So, for instance, the example I gave where previously I was aware of a case where the judge said that being a secretary made this overbroad. Well, blue pencil means that you can just strike that offending word, secretary, and the rest of it remains intact. And so it's kind of like this mechanical exercise. And basically, under the blue pencil concept, a court can't add terms and it can't rewrite it. The red pencil concept would be that they could reform it. And in fact, some states require a reformation. There may also be the possibility that if it is unreasonable at all, the whole thing gets thrown out. Also, there are states where a restrictive covenant isn't legal at all. I think there are three. You can't have any kind of restrictive covenant like that, especially as it relates to the non-competes. And then finally, there are some states where there's just kind of some debate. You know, maybe the state legislature hasn't made a decision on how they want to be, or the courts are inconsistent, or just no consistent law as it relates. But the idea is you need to know if you are going to consider going to war over a restrictive covenant, you need to know how your state is going to interpret it. And obviously, having a competent attorney who litigates employment contracts is going to be helpful to you. But that's how courts will approach it. There's going to be a body of law that tells them, can we strike? Can we remake this? Can we change the restriction down from 10 down to 7 so that we can leave this in place? Is it something where 10's not okay, so we have to throw it out? Those are things that you're going to want to know. And it's also helpful to know these things before you ever sign the contract so that you know what you're getting yourself into. Now, finally, the other question that we get asked that is, again, very, very state specific, but it's important to understand that a restrictive covenant can still apply even if you were fired without cause. A lot of people think that's super unfair. You're going about your business, you're doing everything you're supposed to do, your clinical work's great, and one day the boss walks in and says, hey, Joe, you're fired. And you're like, man, that really sucks, but That wasn't my fault, so I should be able to go practice where I want to. Well, that depends on your contract and it depends on your state. So, for instance, in Texas, someone can fire you without any cause and without any warning and still have this restrictive covenant in place. So it's also something that you need to know. Just because you were fired and fired without cause, and maybe even arguably the practice was at fault, that doesn't mean that your restrictive covenant is thrown out the window. So in summary, I guess the main thing we want clients to know is, A, you shouldn't sign a restrictive covenant thinking that you might break it. You should do your negotiating upfront. And then B, not everything you've heard about restrictive covenants is true. And in fact, there are very, very few hard rules about restrictive covenants. It depends on the state, it depends on the situation, and it depends on the contract that you're actually given. You need to approach it with a lot of thought and advice from your counsel. Well, that concludes our conversation on restrictive covenants today. Thank you so much for joining us again. We'll be back next time.